I'm Laurie Mallon, and this is the Profitable Health Coach Podcast, the show where we're all about creating a sustainable, enjoyable, and profitable online coaching business that gives you the freedom and flexibility that you want. We'll hear about strategies, systems, and solutions from experts and fellow coaches who've created the business of their dreams, providing amazing transformations and connecting with clients across the globe. You'll learn how to get started without the technical overwhelm. Join me on this journey to become a profitable health coach. I am here today with Natalie Bolin, who is a wealth and money mindset coach from Mobile, Alabama. As the owner of Unapologetic Wealth, she teaches financial empowerment, money mindset, and sales training for female service-based entrepreneurs, especially BIPOC women, so that they can step into the wealth they deserve and desire. She's an anti-hustle and pro-abundance coach. She shuns traditional personal finance values that are rooted in shame, guilt, and fear, and encourages her followers to dream bigger, increase their prices, and magnify their gifts. Natalie, thank you for joining us today. I'm really excited to talk about something that we haven't really gotten into on the podcast yet, talking about money. And that can be a really stressful topic. It can be really kind of intimidating. And I'm really hoping that you can come in here and clear some stuff up for us and get us pointed in the right direction.
I hope so. I am so excited to be here. I love talking about money. And I think it is an intimidating topic for most people. I love to remove the fear and the shame and the guilt out of how people feel about their finances. So I'm excited to be here.
Fantastic. And like you just said, so, you know, the fear, the shame, the guilt, and all of that can have an impact on our mental health. And especially if we're business owners, you know, it can be really intimidating if you are just starting a business or you're not really sure how to manage your finances. You know, in the beginning, all you care about is making enough money to keep the doors open. But at some point, we need to kind of get into a more strategic financial planning and like, what are we doing with our money? And what does a successful and profitable business look like in terms of like a balance sheet? So we're going to dig into that. So I like to do this with all my guests. I like to start with your backstory. So what brought you to this point of, you know, where you are today and how and what you offer to your clients?
I was a rule follower. I always have been. I was a straight A student. I never got in trouble. I never been suspended. I've never been in a fist fight. I've always been really respectful and I've always followed authority. I voted. I was a good person. And I went off to college, as all good children do. And I made good grades. And I had a scholarship. And I worked two jobs. And none of it really shielded me from the fact that I was poor or lower middle class. I worked low wage jobs all through college. I waited tables. No one ever said, Natalie, as smart as you are, why are you waiting tables? Everyone said, oh, kudos to you. You're such a hard worker. Congratulations. And I got ingrained in the spirit of, in order for you to be successful, you have to work really hard. And I became that hard worker and I embodied that. And I wore it as a badge of honor, the exhaustion, the obesity, the malnourishment, the poverty. I felt really good about how hard I was working, despite the fact that I had nothing to show for it. I lived in a one bedroom apartment and drove an old car. And through a series of unfortunate successive events, a bad breakup, a job loss, a health scare, I ended up filing bankruptcy with a FICO score over 700. And it crushed me. I was not prepared. I really thought that my years of on-time payments were going to shield me. I thought that it mattered that I had been working for a decade. And, you know, yeah, I had a little rough patch, but my creditors would work with me, right? And, you know, yeah, I've never made a lot of money, but I've always been to work on time. That matters, right? None of that mattered. Laurie, none of it. And I realized that the rules I'm following are destined to keep me poor. There's a rule book we follow in this country called the American Dream, and it keeps poor people poor, and it keeps middle class, and it keeps rich people rich. We're in a caste system of sorts. And what's scary, we don't know we're in a caste system. And I decided, you know, I'm going to educate myself on how money really works. I'm going to get in banking. And I did. And I realized that most banks and most bankers are trained to be product focused. When you go into a bank, they talk to you about their products, their checking, their savings, their mortgage, their credit cards. They don't really talk to you about earning more money. That's not something I've ever heard a personal banker that wasn't me talk about their clients. And when I would talk to my clients about how they can make more money and get better jobs and start businesses, I would get chastised. Natalie, why are you taking so long with customers? Natalie, why are you telling them all that stuff? Natalie, why are you getting so personal with customers? I said, well, maybe he's right. Maybe I should move more into the affluent segment. Maybe I should become a licensed banker. So I did. I got licensed with FINRA. I got my 6 and my 63 and my 65, and I moved to be a brokerage associate. And I stopped seeing Black people altogether. They moved me to a branch where I was the only Black person. I was the only Black person for 5 years. And I was the only woman that wasn't a teller. And every meeting was me and white men who were either retired or almost retired, 60, 65, 68, 72, 80 years old. I had maybe two Black clients in 5.5 years. And that's because our minimum at the firm is $250,000. So if you did not have $250,000 in investable assets, not net worth, I'm talking cash or cash equivalent or money in a brokerage account, then you couldn't even get a meeting. You couldn't even get your foot in the door. And I'm like, well, how do Gen Xers build wealth? How do Gen Y people build wealth? How do millennials get wealth? How do Black people get wealth? How do Hispanic people, how do divorced women get wealth if it take a quarter million to even get a meeting, like an initial meeting? I said, this is flawed. And I said, well, why is it this way? And somebody said, well, we get paid based on the assets under management. We get paid 1% roughly. So you've got to have a big balance for 1% to make sense. So on that 250,000, they're only getting 2,500 a year to manage that account. That's not a lot of money when you really get to thinking about meeting two, three times a year and keeping the notes and the regulations and the taxes. It's 2,500 bucks, right? But that's the system that I found myself in. I found myself in a system of people who didn't look like me ever. I never had a client my age, not one ever. And it dawned on me, I'm gonna be 70 before I win at this system. Like, there's a reason I don't have any 30-year-old clients, because 30-year-old clients can't replicate this system. So I'm just gonna make a new system. And I started Unapologetic Wealth, and I do flat fee based financial planning, meaning you don't have to have a quarter million or half million or a million or 10 million. You don't even have to have 100,000 or 50,000 or 20,000 or 10,000 or 5,000. If you've got a business and an income and a savings, we're good to go. And if you're not at the point where you need a planner, I could coach you. And I'm a money mindset coach, I'm a sales coach, I'm damn good at both. And I help people step into the wealth that they deserve and desire. So that's me. I built a better mousetrap.
I love this. Let's talk a little bit about money mindset, because a couple of things that you mentioned about your story jumped out at me. One of them was in your scenario where you said you had received the message that, you know, be a hard worker, it'll pay off. Go in, wear the badge of, you know, exhaustion, poor health, poor nutrition, all these things to show how hard you're working, and that is somehow going to pay off, and it didn't. So where do we get this, you know, making money or being successful needs to be a result of hard work?
Probably Henry Ford in recent history.
That jerk. All
Men,
right. Yeah. Men.
patriarchy,
Yes. Let's all of that.
Take
So
your pick.
I mean, that is just such garbage,
Yeah.
right? So I want to talk
And
about how do
it's
we
not true. The poorest person you know is the most hardworking person you know. Like, it's just flat out not true. Wealthy people aren't working hard. Only 10% of their wage of their income even comes from wages. They get
Right.
dividends. It's all a farce.
They're making that money. Their money is hard working hard. They're not
Yes,
working
but
hard.
they're not working hard. No.
But they're in that position where they have, you know, they've leveraged some kind of asset to get to the point where they could then it becomes kind of a self-licking lollipop, right? Where it just starts to work for itself,
Yeah.
right?
So then it just does the work, and they just kind of sit there and manage it, or they hire you to manage it, or they, you know, they get somebody to kind of keep an eye on it, making sure that ball keeps rolling.
Right.
But the rest of us, right, we're over here trucking along, doing our thing, thinking that all we got to do is put in the time, get the degree, work the long hours, give up our free time, give up our family time, and then it's all going to pay off. And that is baloney.
Yes.
Where is the shift right there? Where can we make a little tweak in that mindset? What can we replace that thought with, instead of making money, you know, needs to be hard, or hard work leads to making money?
I think people should look at the facts first. If hard work worked, why hasn't it worked yet? Why are you still paycheck to paycheck? Why are you still working two jobs? Why do you still have student loan debt? Why is your husband can't take the vacation that you all want because he can't get time off work? Why do your children have to take out student loans? Why can't you pay off your home early? Why are you struggling with credit card debt? If you're a hard worker and you work hard and you believe that hard work works, then why isn't it working for you? That was what I came up with. It's not working. You have to assess. I think every year, every quarter, you should assess your friends, your neighborhood, your home, your family, your job. You should make an assessment. I made an assessment that following the rules wasn't working. Working hard wasn't working. I was still broke, and I didn't want to be broke anymore. So I was like, you know what? Let me model myself after people who aren't broke. Let me watch wealthy people and talk to them. They're not working 70 hours. They're not working two jobs. They're not doing the snowball method. They're not clipping coupons. They're not on restrictive budgets. They're not foregoing Starbucks.
I knew you were going to say that. Yes, give up your latte.
Why do they tell people to get shamed out of drinking coffee?
Why do they do that to us, right? Rich people get to have coffee all the time.
But it's kind of clever if you think about it. You look at like the Hatfields and the McCoys. They were so busy fighting amongst themselves that other people were able to kind of do whatever they wanted in that town because all the energy. So if you get the poor people and the middle class people fighting with each other, then no one's really messing with the rich people.
Right.
Which is a good position if you're a rich person.
Right.
That's a good position to be in.
But that realization has to kind of be a gut punch, right? Especially if you've lived your whole, like, up to this point under this
assumption. Filing bankruptcy is a gut punch.
So getting to the point where you're realizing that all the baloney you've been fed is, you know, it's not true. So let's talk a little bit about financial empowerment.
Yeah.
What does that term mean?
I think financial empowerment is when you realize that money is a tool. It is neutral. It is not good or bad. It is an inanimate object that can propel you forward towards your goals if you so choose. I think it's a space of enlightenment. Most people fear money, and thus they repel it. They don't want to charge high ticket because, frankly, they think they're bad with money and they're afraid that someone's going to pay them $10,000 and they're going to blow it. They're not going to pay their taxes right. They're not going to file something. Someone's going to sue them. They're going to have a chargeback. Like, they've already built up a whole negative dialogue around, if someone pays me $10,000, then X is going to happen. So see, they've already priced themselves into poverty, and then they've locked themselves into it with their scarcity mindset of, who's going to pay me that? What bad thing is going to happen? More money, more problems. That's a really common thing that we talk about. But it's not necessarily true. Poor people have problems because they don't have the resources to solve them. Like that's a problem. If you are sick and you have money, you can get well. If you are sick and you are poor and you don't have health insurance and you're homeless, you probably won't get well. Like, so yes, there are problems when you're wealthy, but you typically have, like you mentioned earlier, the network, the resources, and the income to solve said problem. Most entrepreneurs are undercapitalized. So there are problems in their business. Their systems are a mess. They don't have a CRM. They don't have the right tech equipment in their home. They don't have a home office. Their kids are running, screaming, interrupting their calls, making them look real unprofessional. Their prescription on their glasses is out to date. They're squinting in the screen. They can barely see. But because they don't have any money, because they're afraid of money and they don't want to actually collect money, and they price at that level of fear, they can't ever level up what they need to do to fix it. So they have these problems for years and years and years and years. I know people who have the same business problem for better part of a decade, but they don't have the capital to fix it. So financial empowerment is saying, you know what? I control money. Money's under my command. I have dominion over it. It's my money. It's mine. I am a steward over this money. I'm allowed to do things with it. And all of my dollars have jobs. And they like jobs. They like to be busy. They like to have purpose. My dollars are so happy right now because they get to like be doled out in such a fastidious manner. You know, they know each other. They have a camaraderie. They grow. They multiply. They are friendly. They're everything I'm not. And they never tire. It's really remarkable what my dollars are out there doing. And that's because I love them and they love me back. And there's just a fear out there around, I'm going to screw up my money. And I'm like, can't screw up what you don't have. If you had more money, you could hire some help. Get an accountant and a bookkeeper. That is probably the turning point for every entrepreneur. And honestly, a lot of W-2 workers could benefit from having an accountant or a bookkeeper. To be honest, that's not just an entrepreneurial thing. Because tax planning is year round. And once you get up over 150, 200K and the middle class tax breaks start to phase out, you know, with being able to write off, say, your contributions to your traditional IRA, hiring somebody is a blessing. But how are you going to hire them if you don't have any money? Like, it always comes back to you got to get over that fear of money. And that's part of why I work with a lot of therapists as well, because some things are outside the scope of what I can fix. Some stuff is literal childhood trauma. And I think that should be addressed as well. Maybe not today, but I think people should address that some of this is not money mindset or pricing. Some of this is flat out unhealed trauma.
And I think you have some resources, maybe some links to books or content or something that I can put in the show notes for anybody who wants to read more about this. I will definitely be putting that in the show notes. So check for that. But let's talk about like what you just said. Sounds like a lot of this is rooted in self-worth, self-esteem, you know, believing what you're capable of. Mm-hmm. And again, a lot of that does come from childhood. But let's talk about, you know, as a business owner and you're starting at, you know, fear-based pricing.
Yeah.
And really being afraid to charge more. And that can also tie back into fear, self-worth.
Right.
Not so much that I don't trust myself to manage the money, but am I worth somebody paying this?
Right. Much? And that happens too. I think we should remove ourselves from the outcome of a sales call or the outcome of a pricing discussion. It's not your job to come up with the money that your client needs to pay you with. It's not your job to work out their budget. Right. So if Laurie was pitching me something right now and it was $25,000, it's not Laurie's job to help me come up with $25,000. Her job is to produce a product with enough value that makes me want to pay her $25,000. So a lot of why people are uncomfortable with their pricing is because they're focused on the wrong thing. They're focused on, no one's going to pay me that. How can someone pay me that? How can I find someone who's going to pay me that? Where is she going to come up with the money? My client's a single mom. My client's a Black woman. My client's a first generation Latino. Her parents grew up in Mexico and she's the first person here. She doesn't have that kind of money. My client, my client, my client, my client. So instead of bettering their programs, improving their self-worth, crafting irresistible messaging, they're in their client's pocketbook, rummaging around for loose change, hoping that there's a check down in there somewhere that they can pay a small deposit. It's no wonder you can't sell if you're focused on the wrong thing. When I get on a sales call, I'm focused on showing the value of the service. That's it. That is my entire premise. No, I want to show my personality as well, but that's going to come out. But I want to show the value of the service. If you hire me, this is what you get. And this is why it's important. And this is how it ties back into what problem you told me you have. So I think if you're in that scarcity-based pricing model right now where you're charging just enough, hoping that someone will buy it, or if you're afraid of rejection and you've priced it low enough to where you think you'll always get a yes, I want to give you two pieces of just thought material. One, would you buy the cheapest option in a grocery store? You go in a grocery store and there's 20 different boxes of cereal. Do you buy the cheapest one? If you go in a grocery store and you need tire monitor, if you need baby bottles, if you need formula for your baby, do you buy the cheapest formula? When you look for a new hairdresser, do you look for the cheapest hairdresser? For most people, price is not the biggest determinant. It's certainly not the only one. Me, I have a big speaking gig in Texas in August. I am not looking for the cheapest hairdresser because I'm going to be on stage in front of 12,000 people. I need my hair to be laid. I need people to go, oh my God, her hair is gorgeous. Her makeup is stunning. Did you see her dress and her shoes? She looked like money. So price is barely even a determinant. I want value and quality. So ask yourself, what makes you different than your client? If you think that the client you're serving is only interested in price and that they only care about the cheapest, one, why are you serving them? That doesn't sound ideal. And two, how do you ever become profitable that way? I think sometimes we forget that the person we serve isn't who we have to serve. So when I worked at the bank, I worked with the public, and anyone who came into the branch, I had to serve them. It didn't matter if they didn't like Black people and said it openly out loud. It didn't matter if they thought I was a junior associate or a secretary or a janitor. Yes, those are real things that happened to me. It doesn't matter if they use racial slurs. It doesn't matter. Nope. I have to serve them when you work with the public. So why would you start a business where you got the same problem as when you work with the public? Why would you do it? One of my mentors likes to say, you need to treat your business like a private club, like a country club, instead of a public park. And don't let people come in and pee on your trees. So stop letting people who aren't ideal get into your funnel. And put the ideal back in ideal client avatar. If the person you sell to can't pay, they're not ideal. Think about it. Ideal means dream. Utopia, perfect, best, superlative. It doesn't mean good enough. If your ideal client can't pay, they're not ideal. It's as simple as that. You just got to up-level who you sell to. What do people need to be before they qualify to pay you? What do people need to do before they qualify to pay you? And what do people need to have before they qualify to pay you and work with you? Stop letting people's budgets, perceived budget at that. I actually know how much some of my clients have because some of my clients, I'm their financial planner and I have like tax returns. Like I know beyond a shadow of doubt what they earn. But 99% of people have no clue what their clients actually make, especially when they're still prospects. Laura, you don't know how much I earn? You have no idea. You never seen my tax returns. You never seen my bank account. So it would be silly for you to try to sell me something based on what you think I can afford because you don't know that number. But you know what number you do know? What your mortgage is, what your life insurance is, your health insurance, your business insurance, your errors and omission, the podcasting equipment, the office you're sitting in, your husband's health insurance, your kids' health insurance, your title and fees and taxes, your estimated quarterly tax payment, your bookkeeper, your accountant, your coach, your lawyer, your contracts, your payment processing fees. These are numbers that you probably know. So why would you price on data you don't have, i.e. how much money my client has and how badly they value a transformation? Because I'll tell you, I hired a $10,000 coach as my first coach and I ain't had $10,000. I'm going to tell you the truth. I put it on a credit card. So you pricing based on perceived client income, perceived client tenacity and resourcefulness, and how badly they want a transformation, which are three variables you don't know, when you could price on all your known valuables. So why would you not do the latter? I feel like people should price from the top, the lifestyle I want, not price from the bottom, what people can afford.
Can we talk for a minute just to tap into what the numbers that you do know and also the value of what you provide?
Yes, that as well. I like to tell people a three-year value. When I have clients, I go, what is the 3-year value of working with you? Because lifetime is nebulous. You don't know how long people are going to live. and you don't know the season with which people will actually invest. And but 3 years, most people will agree that their client will live another 3 years and will value from their offer another 3 years. So if the value of your service is $30,000 over 3 years, well, then it probably shouldn't be $199. And by selling it at $199, you're incongruent. And I don't know that anyone ever talks about what happens when you price yourself out of alignment with your transformation. So I met a health and wellness coach. So I met with her and she talked about health and wellness and nutrition and diet and exercise and wholeness and healing and herbal supplements. It was a lot. And I was like, man, why did I get on the phone with this woman? This is going to be like $15,000. You know what I'm saying? Like, she's listing out the value and I'm like tallying it up in my mind. I'm like, wow, one-on-one group exercise, emails, Voxer. I'm like, damn, this is, I'm running up quite a tab like the whole time. She goes, and so it's $699. I was like, I'm sorry, what? And I was like, a month for like a year? And she was like, well, you know, if you want to keep going and then you can work this out, like you could hear her like, I'm saying it sounds cheap. You mean it's more. But just me mentioning the price, like a question, she started to downsell herself from the $699. Mm-hmm. Like she read it as an objection. I wasn't making an objection. I was making an incredulous statement of how could it be so cheap? But like at the very first hint of, oh my God, I might lose this sale, she started to talk herself down even more. It was easy 15K in value. I didn't invest with her because she might be the best at what she does, but she's not in a viable business model. And I worry about hiring somebody who's going to have to go out of business in 2 or 3 months because they realize that they're broke. And two, are you as good as you claim if you can't put a price out there that honors your talent and value? You went to school to be a nutritionist. You're excellent as a physical trainer. You're going to give me all this one-on-one time and you're going to charge me peanuts. That makes me nervous. I want an expert because my life is on the line. I can't hire a novice. And if you price yourself like a novice, I'm going to believe you're a novice, even if you're an expert. So unfortunately, some people are losing out on money, not because they're too expensive, but because they're too cheap. What they're charging is out of alignment with the value that they are offering, and they are creating mistrust with their clients.
And I think that the reason that a lot of them do that is they're so used to hearing objections because of the prevalence. We're seeing a lot of like fitness apps and the information out there that maybe they're used to hearing objections. So at the first hint of it, they're backpedaling.
But they're like okay. Objections. I love objections. Objections mean you're considering it.
Yep.
The worst thing that can happen on a sales call is for a person to go, I have no questions.
Because they've already made up their mind. They're not going
to buy. Right. And they've already made up their mind, and their mind is a no.
Yep.
Like if people go, no, I have no questions. Nope, not at all. Come on. Y'all aren't. But unless you're the best salesperson in the world and you have a comprehensive sales process that leaves no stone unturned, or unless you have a very compelling client attraction system that pre-sells people before they get on the phone with you, wink, wink. If they have no questions, that's a bad sign. So I like when people start to ask questions because that means they're actually considering giving me their money. They're thinking about it. Like I said, before we had this podcast, I had 2 sales calls this morning. And one of them, she had an objection. She didn't want to start right away. And she wanted to know if we could start in March or April. I said, sure, if you pay the deposit and sign the contract, I'll hold a space for you. That's no problem at all. That wasn't an objection. That was a fact finding because I let her know I work with people in this time frame and we could start as soon as this date. So she just wanted to make sure if she paid me the money that she wasn't going to lose it because she couldn't start on that date. That's not an abject, oh my God, I'm never going to pay you. And even if somebody gave me an outright price objection, be thinking about how you can overcome those. Right? Like flat out. Like what's a common objection that people give when they don't want to buy something?
It's too expensive.
Laurie, you're right. My service is expensive. I appreciate you acknowledging that. I want to take a moment here to coach you a little, if I may. Is that okay?
Absolutely.
So we have to take the stigma off of the word expensive. Expensive is not a bad thing. I think it's important that we show our expertise in a way that positions us as premium in the market. And I have a premium service. I help my clients one-on-one, step-by-step, to assist them in strengthening their sales, marketing themselves better, being visible online, and creating wealth with their business. Because all in all, what good is a business that makes money that doesn't make you wealthy? Now, in your intake form, you mentioned that you've been in business 6 years and you're still not making the money that you want. If you don't hire a coach, what will be different next year? You indicated that you're making $3,000 a month and you want to make $10,000 a month. So it sounds like you're losing $7,000 a month by not taking action. Is that correct? Well, $7,000 a month for a year is a lot more than what I'm charging you here today. Now, I understand that it might feel like an expensive solution, but it sounds like you have an expensive problem, Laurie. I'm willing to help you. How do you feel?
That is, yes, exactly.
You just got to hit it hard. You just can't run from the objection.
Right.
Agree with them. Yes, it's expensive.
I mean, you just did some math there to show me what happens, right?
What happens when you do nothing, right?
If I do nothing, which is, you know, what's going to happen if I say no and I hang up,
And you hang up, you do nothing, and you try for some more. And every month that rolls around, you're losing another $7,000. So, okay, you don't want to pay me $5,000, $10,000 for coaching? Cool, no problem. Keep under earning in your business. I'll allow it. I have to allow it. You're an adult. You have free will. But it's sad, and I'm sad for you. I think I just say the things that other people won't say. I think I'm just bold enough to say what people are thinking.
Exactly.
So I think if people struggle with objections, go ahead and write down maybe the three objections that people have and have a rebuttal to them and start creating content around it. So I'll do you one better. I don't wait for people to object on the phone. I go on Facebook and start putting content out there to answer the objection. So if my objection is, oh my God, that was more expensive than I thought it was going to be. Well, one, how much did you think it would be? When people get on the phone and go, oh, that's more than I thought it would cost. I totally understand that. What were you expecting to pay for the level of service that I've outlined for you? And I make them give me a number. Because then you can figure out where the disconnect is, because maybe this is a person who's just wasting your time and had no intention of paying anything, right? Or maybe they say, well, you know, I thought it was going to be like $3,000 and it's like $5,000. Gotcha. So that $2,000 is a sticking point for you. Is that what I'm hearing? Yeah. $3,000 was really my max, Nat. I really can't go a dollar over that. So I do have payment plans. And what that can allow is time for you to start implementing my strategies and earning some money so you can afford the next payment. I do require a $500 deposit. That's definitely less than the $3,000 you were prepared to spend, correct? Yes, ma'am, that is. So I can send you a contract over. I can let you pay a $500 deposit and I can let you pay $1,500 a month for 3 months. In the first month, you will have only outlaid $2,000 under your $3,000 limit. And this will give you an opportunity to get you a client so you can make that second and third payment. How does that sound? Just address it. And me, my clients all make money. So there's no risk to me that they're not going to pay. They're still signing a contract. I've never had a person not pay me. I attract people of high integrity. I also think if you're getting a lot of objections, your pre-screening process is not strong enough. Right. Because my questionnaire has a range of price on it. And it says I'm going to collect the deposit on the call. Spoiler alert. I typically don't collect the deposit on the call, but I want people to think that I might so that they come prepared to spend.
Yep.
See, so like I get people in the mindset that Natalie's an investment. People don't book calls with me who are not interested in an investment. So think about how you sell. Do you have a desperate energy? Are you willing to get on the phone with anybody who expresses interest? And then you find yourself having to backpedal and discount and coach for free and beg and convince. I ain't convincing anybody to work with me. I'm 33. I am a boss. It took me a long time to get to this point where I feel this good about myself. I am not going to let somebody tear me down over a few thousand dollars. I just can't see it. So I think for most people, it's not just that they're scared of sales. They've never been taught a sales process. And so when things don't go as they planned, and they've only planned for a yes, right? Because they're too afraid to plan for a no or a maybe. Since they've only planned for a yes, when someone doesn't say yes, it knocks them off their game. But again, I like to increase perceived value. So Laurie, you don't see the value. Let me show you the value. Let me present the value to you. By discounting the price, I'm actually lowering the perceived value, which is going to make it even harder for me to sell you. If you didn't want it full price, you don't want it on sale. So I've worked retail. Our sales stuff came back like 70% of the time. I worked at J. Crew. Our full price stuff, people returned 10, 12% of the time. Christmas time, 20% of the time. Sales stuff, we call it boomerang. It's coming right back. And that's why we got to where almost everything that went on sale became final sale. Because it was costing us money to physically mark it down, sell it, bag it, give people receipts, do the payment processing just for it to boomerang back within 7 days and have to re-tag it, re-steam it, put it back out there. It was a job. Making stuff cheap just makes people value it less. That's it. And so if you want to make sales really hard and you want to guarantee that you will never, ever be able to get off the hamster wheel of middle classness, undersell yourself and make your stuff really cheap. I'm going to put an asterisk here. If you've got volume, it's a whole different play. I'm talking about people who are doing the work, like coaches, consultants. They are involved in the delivery. If you are involved in the delivery, it can't be cheap because your time is your greatest asset. If you have a course that you sell on demand and it's $27, I don't care because that sells in your sleep. That's you got your dollars working for you. So I'm not saying low ticket doesn't ever work, but in coaching and consulting and training and speaking, it's a lose-lose because you run out of time and bandwidth before you get wealthy.
So that right there, I'm just gonna let you know right now, I'm gonna be listening to this episode on loop, just like over and over.
Oh yay!
Like I don't know, for the foreseeable future until all of this sinks in. But let's talk a little bit about like the you tapped into it there, the mindset traps of like underpricing, underselling, not being afraid of hearing no, not being prepared for objections. What are some other money mindset traps that new business owners and entrepreneurs are falling into, and how can they get out of them?
New entrepreneurs tend to tell themselves that they can't afford things. I need a coach. I can't afford a coach. I need a bookkeeper. I can't afford a bookkeeper. I need a new website. I can't afford someone to build a website. So they fall into the trap of I can't afford it. And some things are non-negotiable. You're starting a business from scratch with no help and no support and no systems and no money. So you got to get something moving for you. Right. You either got to get a network that can partner with people or money to pay people, or you have to be resourceful enough to do it yourself. So I think the first thing people should do is get a piece of paper and make three columns. And column one is I can do this well enough right now. I have proficiency in this area. The second area is I can do it, but it's going to take me way too long and I need to figure out how I can barter or learn or buy a course. I need to invest, right? And the third column needs to be outsource immediately. I suck at this. Okay, so if you can get you a chart, for me, I knew because of my finance background that I could file my own taxes and do my own books, at least for the first year. I knew that I was an excellent salesperson and I probably would never need to hire a salesperson. And by the time I do need to hire a salesperson, I'll be a millionaire. And I knew that I was willing to put myself out consistently on social media so that I was willing to do my own social media strategy. Am I a pro at all those things? No, but I'm proficient. So get you a proficient column. That's my proficient column. Get you a, you probably ought to invest or barter or get some help or learn, buy a course. Maybe this is a low ticket solution. So for me, it was paying somebody for, some tech help. I got a consultant to come in and just do like an hour. Here are some basic systems you need. I was able to you know, get a cheap domain. My husband built my website, you know, so there are some things in that middle column, you know, help. That third column, outsource what you can't do. You suck at it. And if it's left to you, it's not going to get done. And whatever's in that column, come up with the money to pay for it, period. And don't tell yourself you can't afford it. You can't afford not to do the things in that box. The things in your zone of incompetence, you can't do. And doing them is why you're broke. And doing them is why you're stuck. So it's not that you can't afford. You can't afford not to. So if you're working a W-2, use the proceeds of your job to hire certain things out. I realized that I was never going to get my CRM set up. So I paid someone to set up my Dubsado and put pretty templates on my proposals. And guess what people say now when they get proposed from me? This was so nice. It was so pretty. I really like this. It has FAQs. Again, handling those objections. Mm-hmm. See, I'm handling objections all the time. They're in my questionnaire. They're on my Facebook. They're on my Instagram. They're on my lives. And you get a proposal, they're in the proposal. I make it illogical to do anything other than hire me. But I was able to get to that point because I paid for some help. And that's what new entrepreneurs don't want to do. They tell themselves they can do it all. They're going to do their zone of genius, their zone of excellence, their zone of mediocrity, and their zone of incompetence. And most people's zone of incompetence is pricing and sales, mm-hmm, and marketing and branding and putting themselves out there. That is where most people struggle because of you know, society is harsh. Bullies are real. People are mean. You worry, you know. I put on weight and I put photos up on the internet that are at least 30 pounds heavier than the last round of photos that I did. And my husband's a photographer, so those photos are professionally retouched, you know, the best I've ever looked in my life photos. And I don't feel like I look like that. And it was very hard for me to post those photos. But you know what? People who are struggling with their finances in their business don't give a damn how much I weigh. They're not looking at those pictures thinking Natalie has gotten fat. I might be thinking that. No one else is thinking that. No one else is thinking that. And I think we just have to really get in community with people who lift us up, get you a good therapist, and put yourself out there. But if you're not going to do it, you're going to have to either pay someone to do it or barter with someone to do it. But just not selling, not pricing, it's just not an option. The other money mindset thing you've already talked about, who no one will pay me this. And I think we try to help people like us. So I'll meet women who are teenage moms who want to help single parent teenage moms. And they want to help women who are too poor to afford to help them. I have a lady I met who helps stay-at-home moms. She helps stay-at-home moms with no income. That's who she wants to serve. And I'm like, well, if you help stay-at-home moms with no income, how can they afford to pay you? She's like, well, they can't. That's my problem. I'm not saying don't help stay-at-home moms with no income, but obviously you're not going to be able to charge them what you want to charge them. So are you going to start a nonprofit? Are you going to get donations? Are you going to create a scholarship program? Are you going to have a tiered system where people who make more pay more and people who make less pay less? You're going to have to do something to create a revenue to where you can subsidize the people you want to help. But it takes money to do that. See, some people are they're too invested. They're too close to their target market. They are their target market. Now, I don't want to be expensive because I wouldn't have been able to hire an expensive coach. My first coach coached me for $99 a month. So I want to be $99 a month. Right. But that coach only got you so far. That coach didn't get you to who you are now. And the coach you have now is $3,000 a month. So why would you be $99 a month when your coach is $3,000 a month? You're downloading $3,000 a month worth of value and you're going to give it to someone for $99. I don't want to be mean. I don't want to exclude people. I don't want to be evil. It's evil to be profitable. Like, we just have so much mind trash around good and bad and morality when it comes to money. We really villainize rich people. We think they're bad. We think Elon Musk has trampled on the backs of poor people and, you know, flown wealthy people to Mars. Like, I think he's weird. I don't think he's intrinsically bad. So, and furthermore, if money really changes people, then you be the example. I'm going to show people what it looks like to get obscenely wealthy and not turn into a bad person. You're going to watch that firsthand and you're going to be like, yes, Natalie was right. She is still a good person. And matter of fact, I'm going to be a better person. You know why? Because I'm going to be able to put $100 bills in diaper boxes in Walmart and surprise women. I'm going to be able to go into Walmart layaway and pay off everybody's layaway. I'm going to be able to go to Alabama A&M, my alma mater, and go to the registrar's office and say, I want to pay off everybody's debt that's in this line. Y'all all clear to graduate. It's on me. I'm going to be a better person because I will have resources to do more. And I think it's important to know why you want to get wealthy and visualize that. See, if having a lot of money makes you uncomfortable, you got to get to the root of that first. Otherwise, I'll be pricing and repricing and pricing and repricing your services until I get tired of you and kick you out. I don't do that. That's mean. I will harass you.
That is a great point, though, that, you know, when you're so emotionally connected to who you're trying to help, that you're really like thinking about their situation and pricing in that way, when you could have so much more impact to help that population with more resources. Find somebody who can pay you those big ticket prices and use that money to help the people that you want to help. Offer scholarships, you know, some kind of resources to that group to help them, but don't do it by pricing yourself so low that now you're exhausted. You're having to take on twice as many clients, deliver half the quality product or service that you want to, that you should be able to, in order to bring in the money that you want to bring in and help the people you want to help. Natalie, this has been amazing. I want to talk for one quick second and then we'll wrap up about what it looks like to work with you. You mentioned that you do coaching and you also do financial planning. Yeah. So if somebody wants to connect with you for either one of these, what does that process look like?
Sure. You can join my free Facebook group. I invite people to do that. I go live. I leave money tips there. My Facebook group is Unapologetic Wealth. Super simple. The website is going to be moving from unapologeticwealth.com to nataliebullen.com. So I'll leave both for Laurie in the show notes. That way, depending on when you listen to this, you'll know where to go. You can follow me on Instagram at unapologeticwealth. If you want to hear me talk, you can come to Clubhouse. That's where I live. That's where I give the most value. That is where I'm in my element because my zone of genius is speaking. On Clubhouse, I am at Natalie Bullen. In terms of coaching, I coach women who want more money. I only coach winners. If you are already a winner and you're already an expert and you know your expertise does not match your bank account, I want you. If you are a martyr, I don't want you. In terms of financial planning, you do need to be solid six figures, really like 150K. Annual income to get the most benefit from the services, as I will help you grow your assets, do your estate planning, tax considerations. People lose their wealth in two ways. One is inefficient tax strategy, and the other is poor or absent estate planning, meaning they go through probate. So when you look at Chadwick Boseman, Aretha Franklin, Prince, why do we know so much about their estates? Because they didn't have wills. And so all of that information got put out there publicly. And that's one of the kind of things that I help my clients fix, that they are taken care of here while they're alive and that their family is taken care of after they pass. So good options to work with me. And I'm probably going to be silly in either aspect. Yeah. Not intimidating. Oh, my God. Can you put that in the show notes? Natalie is not intimidating. Okay.
I know I have. She's definitely not. Yes.
I know. My public persona is very stern. I am not.
It's authoritative around a topic where a lot of people have a lot of fear. Yeah. Like there's a lot of baggage there. So you're coming at them in a very sensitive topic. So there's a lot of guardedness maybe. And, you know, and then maybe that's what it is. But, you know, no, Natalie is super fun and easy to talk to. So I'm going to go ahead and throw that in there. Let's wrap up. Yes. Yeah, so let's wrap up. Natalie, can you give us your top three tips for money management, money mindset, anything you got for us?
In terms of money management, you cannot manage what you don't look at. it is imperative that you get some help. If you don't have a bookkeeper and an accountant and you're an entrepreneur, you've done yourself a disservice. I don't care if you only make $2,000 a month. Collective is an option. It's a company that offers an all-in-one service. I know bookkeepers that are as low as $150, $200 a month. It is worthwhile to know exactly what you earn because you can't fix it. And the number one thing I get is, I'm making more than I thought. It's not as bad as I thought. And I'm like, well, what did you think? What were you basing your thoughts on?
Fear.
Fear and not data. So get some data. That's my first biggest tip. Two, remove yourself from caring what people think about you. I joke about how people are intimidated, but I'll tell you the truth. I don't care what people think about me. Not until they're my client. I care what my clients think about me. That I do. But until you're my client.
Don't care.
I mean, because I can't pay my bills with people's thoughts and beliefs. So I think it's important to have your own self-worth intrinsically and know who you are and who you're not and stop letting people convince you otherwise. As my mother would like to say, what other people think about you is none of your business. So I don't ask people what they think about me and they usually don't tell me. And that's a gift. Third, you need to up-level your circle, as my father, Nathaniel Johnson, would say. If you hang around four broke people, you sure to be the fifth. A lot of us are struggling because we surround ourselves with people who are in the same predicament as us. When I lost 40 pounds in 2020, it's because I started hanging around fit people. I didn't hang around the same overweight friends that I had that wanted to go to Chili's and have drinks. I went on the track with fit people. So if you want to be wealthy, introduce yourself to wealthy people. Get uncomfortable. Shoot some DMs. Hey, I want you on my podcast. Hey, could you co-author a book with me? I'm doing an anthology. Hey, can you do a speaking gig at the Boys and Girls Club? I do free financial literacy speaking engagements for nonprofits. People barely even ask me to do them because they're intimidated by me. They're afraid to even reach out because they think I'm going to bite their head off and tell them they're poor or something, right? Like, you have to get uncomfortable. I did a clubhouse room with Myron Golden, a very, very wealthy man. Right. Your eyes tell me you know who that is.
I know who that is. Yes.
Myron Golden knows who I am. I attracted him into my room on Clubhouse and got him on stage with me three different times. I have recordings for proof. And he told me he was impressed by me. That's major.
That's so when you just tap out. You've made it. You're done.
What can you do to start attracting multimillionaires to you where they want to share a Clubhouse stage with you and talk about how you can help them? That's a big deal. And I wouldn't have been able to attract him if I wasn't talking about making more money in that room that day. If I had been a regular old financial planner who talks about budgeting and saving and index funds, I wouldn't have attracted Myron Golden because he's way past that level of investment. But talking about how we can step into the wealth we deserve and desire, and we can have as much money as we want. Because he has $1 million coaching program per person. That's not like a B2B price. That's a B2C price. So next time you tell yourself what people will and won't pay for, give them the option. Stop being afraid that people won't choose you. I gave two women the option this morning to work with me. I would be elated if they take it, but I won't be crushed if they don't. Because my value is immeasurable and anyone who works with me is blessed and their business is blessed. And because I believe that the outcome is, I'm completely detached from the outcome of those calls. And that's the point you got to get to. Most of us are just, again, we're too close up on that problem because we're in financial duress. We're trying to figure out how we're going to pay our mortgage on the first and it's the third. So we're too close up on our problem to have enough space to see, you know what? If I position myself differently, I won't need as many clients and I won't have to work myself to the bone and I'll attract a better type of clientele. You know, if you're selling one-off calls for $199, bundle that thing up. Tell people you'll work with them for 3 months for $5,000. If they say, no, that's too expensive, I can only pay you three, take the three. Hell, you was doing it for $199. You still won. At least you had somewhere to negotiate down from. But stop giving your client all the power, you know, stop giving your client the power to pay you what they want to pay, when they want to pay, if they want to pay, as they need help. You the expert, tell them that they need the help and tell them what it costs.
So a lot of the coaches and people in like the consulting and health and wellness space have spent all their time and energy and money in learning how to help their clients. And literally none of that, none of their time or energy has been spent in learning how to run a business, learning how to sell their services. They literally need the most help in this place, because if you don't have a client, you can't deliver. Right. So they know how to be a good nutritionist. They know how to be a good personal trainer, but they don't know how to bring in clients.
Yeah. And exactly. They're experts. They're great at what they do. But that next point of how do you find somebody?
And then the part two of that is that they kind of latch on, or they see somebody doing something and they try to reverse engineer their strategy based on what they see somebody else doing, not realizing all the other moving parts that are happening behind it, the psychology of the content that they're creating, and they don't understand it. So they show up, they create a Facebook page, they throw a bunch of posts up, they create a Facebook group, they might do a couple of things here and there. They can't understand why people aren't knocking down their doors to work with them. And I'm like, you are not telling them what they need to hear to get them on board.
To get them on board. Like, you're not giving them the information that they need to have.
Yeah. And also a lot of them want to help everybody. So they're really scared of niching down. They're really scared about being specific and creating that ideal client avatar because, you know, they're qualified to help everyone. So they don't want to close any doors. You
yeah,
know?
But I do. I love closing doors.
I do too. I'm like, bye.
I don't, because I've the few times I have gone outside of my ideal client to help someone, I got burned. Mm-hmm. It has never worked out for me. I don't recommend it to anybody. I don't do a lot of stuff the industry says. Like, even my sales calls aren't free.
Right.
Like, I charge a fee to get on a sales call with me because I hate doing sales calls. I'd rather do a paid consultation, or I'd rather you just buy it in the DMs. But if you want a sales call, it's $25. Now, $25 is no money, but it's just enough money to keep people who have no intention of ever hiring a coach off the phone. Mm-hmm. Because the people who I used to do, when I used to let people get on the phone for free, they either wouldn't show or they wouldn't buy. Mm-hmm. They'd be shopping around. I literally met a woman who told me she was interviewing people. And that was the word she used. She's like, yeah, I'm interviewing coaches right now. It just rubbed me the wrong way. I'm not saying she was wrong to get more than one opinion, but it seemed like it was like seven of them. Like, it just seemed like I could see the thread where it started. You know how people do. It's, oh, I'm looking for this and this. And then like 30 people jump on like piranha.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, me, I want the business. Me, I want the business, you know? And I like people who are like, you know what? I got to work with Natalie. I don't care what it costs. I don't care. She's right. I do deserve more money. She's spot on. And I don't have people coming to me. How's she doing that? And I don't have an authentic voice on Facebook. How's she doing that? And she says she's an introvert and she gets 8 hours of sleep at night and she's newlywed. How's she doing that?
You know, one thing that you said that blew my mind, and I was like, if I ever talk to her, I need to find out more about this. You said one time that you send 42 DMs a day.
I do.
And I'm like, what are the logistics of that? Because that would, like, I'm just thinking of, like, how do you track that? What are you saying? Who are you talking, how does that even work?
The story behind the 42 DMs is funny. I really hadn't had a sale in a couple days. And at that point, I was used to making money every day because I was selling like low cost workshops and one time calls. So, you know, 2 days without money was just unacceptable to me. And so I decided I wasn't closing that clubhouse room and going to bed until someone gave me some money. So I just started DMing people, and it took me 42 people before someone paid me. And I ended the room and I went to sleep, and I said, well, at least now I know the number. If I do this every day, then I'll have the outreach that I need. So I leave a lot of voice notes, like a lot of voice notes, to people who I think might be a good fit. I'll give you an example. Hey, Jessica, thank you so much for reaching out to me. Hey, I saw your post about preferring to move to applications. It really depends. So I like an application. If you do it separately, though, it creates more work. So if you have people go to your site and fill out an application and then you have to actually approve or deny, you need a workflow or a system where you get an email about the application and then you need a workflow where you can approve them. And then what does that take them to? Does that take them to a call or are they in? Does that take them to a page where they make a deposit? So just be aware of the tech and systems and automations implication of moving to an application. When you don't have an application and people can just book and pay and get on your calendar, it's easier, it's simpler, but then you've got to do more screening on the back end. Tell me a little bit more about the group that you're launching and I'll let you know whether I think an application is appropriate. So that was 56 seconds. And she is going to listen to that and think, wow, she gave me really personalized answer. She read my answer. She cares, right? Is that particularly a sales conversation? No, they don't all have to be. But to me, sales is service. I serve people, right? And I just keep moving them into the funnel. At some point, she might write back and go, I'm totally overwhelmed and I don't know if I should do an application or not. And I'm an H1 and I don't even really have money to try it out. Like I'm trying to quit my job. My job's burning me out. And I could go, you know what? You should use that job and your income from your job to leverage, to use for leveraging your business. Based on what you told me, here are the people I think you should hire. It's not always me, but because I'm a Rolodex, that's valuable as well. So people will circle back, Yeah. So I just threw out the day as the day goes on. I probably sent 10 today. It's 10:55 in the morning. Well, that's great. I'm like a quarter of the way there. My most promising leads, I actually manually put it in an Excel spreadsheet with what we talked about and when the last time I talked to them. And whether I left them a voice memo or a typed message so I can track people who might actually turn into clients.
Okay, Natalie, this has been amazing. And I want to thank you so much for coming on here and sharing all this amazing information and knowledge about and the tips. Oh my gosh, I'm going to be listening to this on repeat for the foreseeable future because so much good information here about mindset and just managing our finances personally and professionally and running our businesses. This has been amazing. Thank you so much for being here today.
You are so welcome.
Thanks for listening. And if you liked this episode, go ahead and leave us a review on iTunes or wherever you listen to podcasts. And be sure to subscribe so you'll be notified when the next episode is live. Check out our show notes for this episode where you can find any of the links and resources that were mentioned during the show. Thanks for listening, and we'll catch you in the next episode.